Welcome to Rural EdMed. I am Serena Wilson, an acute care nurse practitioner, and I am speaking on skin and soft tissue infections. Hippocrates, a 5th century BC physician and philosopher, was the first man to describe skin infections. It's not surprising, although he may not have been the first to discuss and theorize about illness and infection. He was the first to systematically record symptoms and characteristics of his patients and their illnesses. He lived in a time when infection was attributed to supernatural forces and instead insisted that disease resulted from external natural forces. He wrote many manuscripts on infectious diseases, with one devoted entirely to skin wounds called On Ulcers. He compared wet and dry ulcers, ulcers that formed exudate, and ulcers that bled, determining that bleeding ulcers were less likely to later become inflamed or infected. Hippocrates noted that inflamed wounds, or wounds that split open and whose edges did not approximate, tended to heal much slower. He referred to skin and soft tissue infections as erysipelas. He was particularly intrigued with a form of erysipelas that seemed to spread and corrode most powerfully in all directions until the flesh, sinew, and bone fell away. We would later refer to this condition as one of the most severe and frightening forms of skin and soft tissue infection, necrotizing fasciitis. In 1871, during the Civil War, a Confederate Army surgeon by the name of Joseph Jones provided written accounts of what he referred to as hospital gangrene. As a physician and avid researcher, he took it upon himself to closely document a number of medical conditions that took place during the war. He eventually made the connection between open wounds being directly exposed to matter from gangrenous wounds and later becoming gangrenous themselves. He described an incident where a man developed hospital gangrene, and as was common at the time, his wife came to care for him. She wore new shoes, which caused a blister on her foot, so she removed them and walked in the hospital barefoot. The blistered area soon after developed gangrene. He was also known for his preoccupation with the microscope. These instruments were relatively low-powered, but he was still able to visualize small, mobile organisms in the matter obtained from gangrenous wounds. At the time, the world was not familiar with bacteria or germ theory. The following is a quote from Jones related to these animalcules, as he referred to these organisms. In the present state of our knowledge, we are unable to demonstrate that these animalcules are in any way connected with the origin and spread of hospital gangrene. The gangrenous matter seems to afford a nidus in which these simple forms of animal and even vegetable life are rapidly generated and multiplied. The connection between bacteria and infection was made during his lifetime, and he eventually went back and took credit for being the first to discover the organism responsible for hospital gangrene. Jones was also the first to suggest surgical debridement in the treatment of what was probably necrotizing fasciitis. He recommended using a scalpel or scissors to remove all gangrenous material until a wound freely bled, and then suggested brushing concentrated fuming nitric acid over all parts of the wound. He was a strong proponent for disposing of all materials used on the wounds of hospital gangrene patients, extreme cleanliness, and lower patient-to-nurse ratios to care for these patients. Some excerpts of reports from a military prison hospital to Joseph Jones included extremities covered with blue or livid spots that would spread, become painful, open, and ulcerate. Accompanying symptoms included a weak pulse, great anxiety of continence, with a foul grayish slough all over the surface of the wound or ulcer, which discharges a large quantity of filthy and very offensive sanies, destroying muscles and everything before it down to the bone. If an operation be not resorted to, we have hemorrhage, caused by destruction of the blood vessels of the part. Limbs were amputated, and gangrene would then reappear in a stump and speedily destroy the patient. In the same report, there are descriptions of overcrowding, poor sanitation with sharing of basins and even bandages between infected and non-infected individuals, and accounts of even healthy prisoners coming down with hospital gangrene. Those who received surgical amputation at that hospital all developed gangrene of the stump and subsequently died. In 1883, a type of necrotizing fasciitis confined to the perineal area was described by venereologists by the name of Jean Alfred Fournier. This later became known as Fournier's gangrene. Unlike the majority of necrotizing fasciitis cases, this type of gangrene was almost always of polymicrobial source. Fournier's gangrene originates with a small infection of the genitalia, urethral tract, various glands, a colorectal injury or trauma. It is mainly a disease of the immunocompromised, especially diabetics. Fournier's life work was actually on the topic of syphilis, and he only described this type of gangrene incidentally, but he would become known for his description of what would thereafter carry his same name. War has historically been a time of great strides in our understanding of infection and disease. If you refer back to the sepsis lecture, much of what we gleaned about sepsis came from studies of war wounds and subsequent infection. The Civil War in particular brought us great understanding of modern-day disease. Conditions were poor, unsanitary, amputation and traumatic injury were rampant. The physicians and nurses caring for wounded soldiers were too few in number and barely trained. While they came to understand the connection between cleanliness and health, they did not have the means, time, or knowledge to sterilize or often even wash equipment between patients. Those who survived amputation then went on to suffer surgical fevers, the term for postoperative skin and soft tissue infections. World War I brought trench foot, brought on by wet, cold, and unsanitary conditions, and often resulting in amputation. Trench references trench war, which was popularized during this time. Feet would turn blue or red, swell, and form blisters. They often became infected. Later, they became gangrenous. The military practice of carrying multiple pairs of socks into the trenches actually cut down rates of this malady tremendously. World War I also brought recognition that wounds would need removal of foreign materials and dead tissue. Silver foil dressings were used as an antiseptic measure. Wounds were cultured, and infecting bacterial characteristics and healing were documented at length. Hemolytic streptococcus was recognized as a particularly violent skin infection with copious pus formation and poorer healing outcomes. By World War II, we had antibiotics. We recognized the importance of sterilized instruments and hand washing. The Vietnam War brought specialized burn care and burn centers. The history all spiraled from there into what is known today in modern medicine. Skin and soft tissue infections are classified according to how deep they go. The outermost layer of the skin is known as the epidermis. Under that is the dermis. This is the usual depth where infections such as cellulitis and erysipelas are found. Next is the layer of fat, followed by the fascia, and then the muscle. Necrotizing fasciitis involves infection that moves along the fascia and then upwards. Myositis is the infection of the muscle itself. Skin is the first barrier to infection. The epidermis is made up of keratinocytes. These cells start out as undifferentiated, rapidly dividing cells near the basement membrane that separates the epidermis from the dermis. As they differentiate over time, they move up through the layers of the epidermis, mainly the stratum spinosum, stratum granulosum, and stratum corneum. Once they serve their function in the stratum corneum, they desquamate, shed, and are replaced. This entire cycle of keratinocyte life takes 40 to 56 days. The dermis is made up of extracellular matrix proteins and provides the strength and elasticity of the skin. When there is a break in the integrity of the skin, clotting cells move into the wound and form a scab, and inflammatory cells clean the area. Fibroblasts also move to the wound bed and secrete granulation tissue. Epithelial cells from the surrounding skin areas proliferate and slowly cover the wound. Skin resists infection in a number of ways that are distinct from just providing a physical barrier. There are macrophages and other immune cells in the dermis, and a specialized macrophage that migrates and settles into tissues known as Langerhans cells in the epidermis. Breakdown products produced during epidermal cell differentiation lower the pH of the skin, which also inhibits bacterial growth. Normal flora, or resident good bacteria that live on the skin naturally and do not cause infection, also prevent overgrowth of dangerous types of bacteria. Keratinocytes in the epidermis have something called pattern recognition receptors, which are able to recognize portions of dangerous bacteria and activate the immune system to fight it. The typical presentation of skin and soft tissue infection is warmth, erythema, edema, and pain. There may or may not be an obvious break or ulcer of the skin. It is important to take a complete history, noting the order of occurring events. Specifically, did the pain or visible inflammation occur first? This can distinguish deeper infections that have moved to the surface from superficial infections, although not with complete accuracy. Note characteristics such as size, whether it is raised above the surface of the skin, whether there are distinct masses present, and exudate or drainage. There are both infectious and non-infectious causes of warmth, erythema, and edema that must be ruled out before diagnosing a skin and soft tissue infection. Deep vein thrombosis, or DVT, may present with unilateral extremity edema and significant pain, especially with compression. DVTs do not present with unilateral limb erythema, however. The extremity may be red or pink due to baseline conditions such as venous insufficiency, but this should be bilateral. Vasculitis presents with non-blanchable macular or papular lesions. Edema is not usually present. Both septic arthritis and gout present with erythema, edema, and pain, but are always found overlying a joint. Shingles causes erythema with numerous vesicles that may be confused with blisters. There may or may not be accompanying edema. They are exquisitely tender. This rash will follow one or two dermatomes and never crosses the midline. Erythematous areas that are pruritic rather than painful raise suspicion for dermatitis, drug reaction, or insect bite. Early erythema migrans from a tick bite may initially present as erythema and later develop the characteristic central clearing or bullseye appearance. This rash can be accompanied by a burning sensation or pruritus, but usually does not hurt. Once you have determined that you truly have a skin and soft tissue infection, the first step in managing this is to consider your must-not-miss diagnoses. These infections can cause a patient to exhibit systemic symptoms. We call this a toxic presentation. They include the criteria for sepsis, such as leukocytosis, tachycardia, tachypnea, and hypotension. A diagnosis of sepsis only requires a patient have two of these things, plus a suspected infection. Other toxic presentations include new renal or liver failure, hypoxia, and mental status changes. The presence of cellulitis, infected diabetic foot ulcers, and even occasionally abscesses can lead to a toxic presentation. With any toxic presentation, your must-not-miss diagnosis is necrotizing infection. This is because antibiotics alone will not cure it, no matter how appropriate your coverage is. Necrotizing infections are classified by the area infected and infecting organism. Necrotizing fasciitis occurs in the fat and muscle fascia. Necrotizing myositis is infection of the muscle. One may lead to the other. A type 1 infection is a mixed infection caused by any combination of aerobic and anaerobic organisms, including those organisms responsible for monomicrobial infections. These infections are usually those in genital or head and neck regions, such as Fournier's gangrene and infections resulting from diabetic ulcers. Risk factors include diabetes, peripheral vascular disease, immune compromise, and recent surgery. Type 1 infections are commonly associated with the presence of subcutaneous gas. Type 2 infections, and by far the most common source, arise from a single organism. Risk factors include injury or translocation of strep pharyngitis, burns, blunt trauma, recent surgery, childbirth, IV drug use, and varicella infection. Group A strep is the most isolated single organism resulting in necrotizing infection, although MRSA cases, especially community-acquired, are on the rise. There is also a type of bacteria found in seawater and raw seafood, which can enter the skin through a break or lesion and cause type 2 necrotizing infection known as Vibrio vulnificus. Some sources separate Vibrio and Clostridium monomicrobial sources into a third category, type 3 infections. Risk factors for Clostridium infection mostly consist of IV drug use due to advances in medical care. It used to be common with penetrating traumatic injuries that were not treated right away, such as knife or bullet wounds. Vibrio infections occur with concurrent interruption in the cutaneous barrier and exposure to contaminated water, usually in the setting of immunocompromise. So what is the difference between your usual strep infection and type 2 necrotizing fasciitis, you might ask? It is a matter of invasiveness. Non-invasive strep infections include rheumatic and scarlet fever and impetigo. When the same bacteria infects blood, muscle, or lungs, it is considered an invasive infection. One of the charge nurses where I work told me a story that illustrates this. She said a nurse was caring for a patient that ended up having group A strep necrotizing fasciitis. The nurse was exposed but did not develop a skin infection. Rather, she came down with strep throat. While I cannot speak to this particular case, it is likely. The bacteria itself is contagious. The invasive infection is not. Necrotizing fasciitis is impossible to distinguish from cellulitis in its early stages. It is an infection of the subcutaneous tissue and muscle fascia that spreads along the margin of the muscle as fast as 3 centimeters per hour. The patient may complain of fever, malaise, vomiting, diarrhea, and pain out of proportion to any visible injury. As with most injuries, diabetics may have a decreased sensation of pain and so may not report this finding. Pain usually precedes visible signs of infection. Then erythema and edema forms with indistinct margins. A patient may develop cutaneous blue-gray patches or blisters. Blisters may start out with the usual clear fluid, but as the infection progresses, the blisters will have a dishwater-colored and then dark purple, almost black fluid. Later, the skin will become gangrenous with resolution of pain when surface nerves die. Crepitus is a late sign of approximately 18% of patients presenting with necrotizing fasciitis. Subcutaneous gas is most often associated with type 1 infections. The difficulty with necrotizing infection is that there is no easy, validated, and accurate way to diagnose it. The laboratory risk indicator in necrotizing fasciitis score, or Lyrinex score, was developed to predict likelihood of necrotizing infection based on laboratory values. It was initially found to have both a sensitivity and specificity in the 90th percentile. A score of 6 indicates a high likelihood of necrotizing fasciitis. The lab values include CRP, glucose, creatinine, white blood cells, hemoglobin, and sodium. It has been retrospectively validated, but not prospectively. A later study also showed a high number of necrotizing infection cases that had an initial larynx scores of less than 6, although those with higher scores and necrotizing infection had worse outcomes. It is important to remember that this scale was created to be used in situations where there is already some suspicion of necrotizing infection. It is not diagnostic, and some small-scale research suggests that it is better at ruling out necrotizing infection than ruling in. X-rays and CT scans only show muscle involvement and subcutaneous gas, both of which are often not present, with the exception of necrotizing myonecrosis. These modalities may indicate deep abscess or inflammatory changes, however. The only absolutely accurate way of diagnosing necrotizing infection is with biopsy. Necrotizing myonecrosis is an infection of the muscle. It occurs due to introduction of bacteria, either through some deep trauma combined with decreased perfusion, or when there is a spontaneous break in the gastrointestinal system and subsequent seeding of the muscle with common GI organisms such as Clostridium. The second one may occur with colon cancer or due to a weakened intestinal wall secondary, as with radiation therapy, making it easy to miss diagnosis. Manifestations usually begin with a sudden onset of severe muscle pain or pain at the site of trauma or surgery. The skin overlying that muscle or surrounding the area of trauma may be pale, bronze, or purplish, with blisters filled with clear, dishwater-colored or purple fluid, depending on the stage of progression. Unlike most other diseases of the muscle, the CK will not be elevated. As with all necrotizing infections, purulent drainage is rare. Treatment for necrotizing infection includes treatment of sepsis, broad-spectrum antibiotics, and early and aggressive debridement. Once infected tissues are opened, they are usually easily separated, grayish with dishwater-colored drainage, and do not bleed. Debridement is done down to the level of bleeding viable tissue. The wound is left open. Most patients with necrotizing infection will require multiple debridements. Antimicrobial choices will be necessarily broad because you will not be able to immediately determine the offending organism. You will want to cover for strep, staph including MRSA, clostridium, and anaerobes. Penicillin G and ampicillin cover strep and clostridium. Clindamycin or metronidazole cover anaerobes. Clindamycin also covers strep and MRSA. As always, Vanco also covers MRSA. Carbapenems, aminoglycosides, fluoroquinolones, and fourth or third generation cephalosporins provide gram-negative coverage. Combination agents such as Zosyn will cover strep, clostridium, and gram-negatives. There have been limited studies evaluating the effectiveness of IV immunoglobulin and hyperbaric oxygen therapy, but to date neither therapy has been shown to be advantageous. Post-surgical wound care and adequate nutrition are essential for recovery. A fluctuant, acutely tender, inflamed mass may indicate abscess. An abscess is a walled-off pocket of infection. It can be surface, deep, and even internal on organs and within cavities. A skin and soft tissue abscess is fluctuant or moves when pressed on because of the fluid or pus contained within it. They are usually surrounded by a red, swollen ring of skin. They can spontaneously break open and drain purulent fluid. They are very seldom associated with sepsis or other toxic syndromes. The most frequent infecting organism is Staphylococcus aureus, either methicillin-resistant or susceptible, as in MRSA or MSSA. The source may also be polymicrobial. This is the most common in abscesses located in the genital, perineal, and oral areas. If you are unsure whether an infection is actually an abscess, an ultrasound evaluation may be useful. It has been suggested that being a carrier of Staph aureus increases risk of developing an abscess. Being in close contact with someone who has an abscess also increases risk, especially if personal items are shared which have come in contact with that abscess. Repeated skin trauma, such as with IV drug use, predisposes as well. Treatment includes incision and drainage, being sure to remove all purulent material and break up any loculations or walled-off compartments. Packing the cleaned-out area has been shown to increase pain but not improve outcomes, and so is no longer recommended. Antibiotics are not necessary for uncomplicated abscesses. Antibiotics may be helpful in patients presenting as toxic, immunocompromised individuals, and may be considered in MRSA infections when there are multiple lesions or baseline immunocompromise. There are currently two major randomized controlled trials sponsored by the National Institutes of Health that are looking at the efficacy of antibiotic use in patients with unusually large abscesses, comorbidities such as diabetes, patients with fever, or surrounding cellulitis. As of now, we just don't know whether these patients should be treated. Tradition usually dictates that we do, although oral antibiotics are often considered sufficient. Antibiotics are also given with recurrent abscess formation to target the infecting organism. Known carriers who have recurrent abscesses are often decolonized with intranasal mupirocin and chlorhexidine baths. Finally, patients at risk for endocarditis should receive at least one dose of antibiotics with activity against MRSA before incision and drainage. At-risk patients include those with prosthetic heart valves, a prior history of infective endocarditis, and this is the most significant risk factor, unrepaired cyanotic congenital heart disease, or repaired with residual defect, or transplanted, not native, heart with valvulopathy. Another risk is abscesses in the muscle or pyomyositis. This occurs via seeding of infection from bacteremia. Any infection that seeds via the blood can also seed heart valves. Once you have ruled out differentials, necrotizing infection, and abscess, you are left with cellulitis. Unfortunately, this is not as simple as it seems. Treatment options are affected by the source of infection, be it infected diabetic ulcer, surgical site, or dog bite. Cellulitis can be complicated by osteomyelitis or sepsis, comorbidities, or immunosuppression. Cellulitis can affect the epidermis only, such as erysipelas, or both the epidermis and dermis. Erysipelas is an infection of the superficial dermal layers that sometimes involves lymphatics. Lymphedema is the most common risk factor, and due to lymphatic involvement with erysipelas and subsequent worsening of lymphatic drainage, erysipelas is also a risk factor for worsening lymphedema. Other major risk factors include prior episode of erysipelas, wound or skin breakdown, such as can occur with athlete's foot, yeast skin infections and most rashes, and venous insufficiency. It is most often the result of group A strep infection. Because of its superficial nature, it appears as a clearly demarcated plaque that is raised above the usual level of the skin. Erysipelas is described as fiery red in color and may be accompanied by red streaks indicative of lymphangitis. These may be lymph node involvement. There may be. It is most often found on the lower extremities, but may also occur on the face where it appears as a butterfly rash similar to that produced in lupus. This location is particularly dangerous because of extension of the infection can lead to septic cavernosis thrombosis due to its proximity to the sinuses. This usually begins with a terrible headache and progresses to ptosis, mydriasis, gaze palsies, periorbital swelling, and eventually blindness. It starts out as unilateral, but because the sinuses are connected, it becomes bilateral. This can be diagnosed with a CT or MRI of the head. Facial erysipelas is the only kind that really needs to be differentiated from cellulitis. Symptoms are very similar and both may lead to fever, nausea, vomiting, and even systemic toxic signs. Both are treated similarly. Severe cases of erysipelas are treated with penicillin, first or third generation cephalosporins, clindamycin, or vancomycin. Diabetic foot ulcers can become infected and lead to cellulitis. They are often colonized with polymicrobial organisms, so culture results alone cannot diagnose the cause of infection. Diabetics are prone to cellulitis because of high glucose with accompanying impairments of the immune system, neuropathy with inability to feel when the limb is injured, and peripheral vascular disease, among others. Diabetics are especially prone to osteomyelitis, which we will come back to in a minute. They are more often infected with resistant organisms such as MRSA and extended spectrum beta-lactamases. The severity of cellulitis determines appropriate antibiotic therapy. Purulent drainage always requires agents effective in the treatment of MRSA, such as Bactrim, clindamycin, and vancomycin. Mild infection is covered for staph and strep. Commonly used drugs include cefalexin, dicloxacillin, and augmentin, all of which can be given orally. Moderate to severe infections are covered for staph, strep, aerobic gram-negative bacilli, and anaerobes. A fluoroquine alone can be added to the previously mentioned regimen. Antibiotic therapy is usually given for 2 to 4 weeks if the patient required hospitalization. Debridement is often needed. Sharp debridement is the choice method for those not suffering from peripheral arterial disease or other forms of vascular compromise. Enzymatic debridement is used in these cases. Surgical debridement may be necessary for deep infections, abscesses, or bone and joint involvement. Providing relief of pressure on the wound is essential. This may be done with bed rest, special shoes, or splints. Osteomyelitis is an infection of the bone. This can occur with severe soft tissue infection that spreads to the bone, trauma or puncture which directly inoculates the bone, or through seeding associated with bacteremia. It can be caused by soft tissue infection or lead to it. It can also lead to septic arthritis when the infection moves into the joint. Symptoms include overlying tissue edema, erythema, warmth, tenderness, a draining sinus tract, fever, and possibly rigors. Treatment includes debridement, removal of infected hardware if present, revascularization if needed, and broad-spectrum antibiotics. It is important to keep in mind that bone concentration of antibiotics will be much lower than that of the serum. Not all antibiotics penetrate bone the same. Vancomycin is still used for MRSA and Coag negative staph at 30 mg per kilogram divided in 2 equal doses daily. Empiric therapy usually includes this and an agent that covers gram-negative organisms such as fluoroquinolones, ceftazidime, and cefepime. Fluoroquinolones have high levels of bone penetration even when given orally. Antibiotic therapy is usually given for 6 weeks following the last debridement, sooner if amputation is done, due to poor and unreliable bone absorption of medication. If the patient is not a candidate for surgery, antibiotics may be continued from 6 months to life. Hyperbaric oxygen is being studied in this population and shows promise in the treatment of refractory cases. Surgical site infection-related cellulitis also presents with erythema, edema, pain, fever, and sometimes purulent exudate. The infecting organism is most often staph, although other organisms may infect. Typically, staph infection causes a postoperative fever about 5 to 8 days following the surgery. Clostridium and hemolytic strep cause a fever much sooner and may be confused with a typical postoperative fever. If suspected, obtain a gram stain and culture, preferably by fine needle aspiration. You may need a CT or ultrasound to rule out abscess. Antibiotic choices and debridement recommendations are identical to other skin and soft tissue infections. Just be aware that while usually caused by staph, it is frequently also caused by strep. Some antibiotics, such as Bactrim and doxycycline, cover staph well, but not strep. Risk factors for surgical site infections include lack of sanitation, high traffic in the surgery suite, longer surgeries, patient obesity, diabetes, tobacco use, immunosuppression, and malnutrition. Animal bites differ from other types of cellulitis sources in the kinds of pathogens contained within the wound, which usually include both aerobic and anaerobic organisms. Pasteurella is the most common bug causing infection after both dog and cat bites. Strep anginosus for human bites. The hand is a particularly common site for both sustaining a bite injury and actually developing an infection. The hand contains many tendons and is comparatively avascular to other parts of the body. The hand also contains many small, delicate bones, and the patient may go for some time without realizing an underlying fracture. Then there is the matter of disease transmission. With animals, rabies is of concern. With humans, we worry about hepatitis B and C and syphilis. Like other causes of cellulitis, these infections are irrigated and debrided. Closure of infected wounds remains controversial, but is usually not recommended if it can be avoided. Empiric therapy with a beta-lactam, lactamase inhibitor, carbapenem, or doxycycline is generally used as treatment. If the patient is allergic to penicillin, you may try a combination of a fluoroquinolone plus either clindamycin or Bactrim plus metronidazole. The term immunocompromised refers to a number of conditions, from chronic use of medications such as corticosteroids and immunomodulators to conditions such as AIDS and cancer, especially the lymphoma kind. Immunocompromised individuals are more likely to suffer from cellulitis due to atypical organisms such as mycobacteria, cryptococcus, and pseudomonas. You should think about fungi when a patient is just not responding to any treatment or in patients known to be at risk for these infections. You should cover for pseudomonas in every patient who is neutropenic and consider it in any patient at risk for opportunistic infections. Mycobacteria infections are extremely resistant. This is due to fast and numerous mutations and hibernating-like activity. Usually, combination therapy is required as well as very long treatment times to ensure eradication of all of the infection during its metabolism stage. An infectious disease consult should usually be obtained if you suspect any of these infecting organisms. Finally, there are a number of interventions that are appropriate in every case of cellulitis. The affected extremity should be elevated. This allows inflammatory mediators to drain away from the site of infection, as well as lessen any edema, which is in itself a risk factor for the development of soft tissue infection. Any other factors that predispose to infection should also be corrected. This includes treating tinea pedis infections, lymphedema, abscesses, and hyperglycemia. The area of cellulitis should be marked, and serial exams are done to determine worsening or improvement. Consider the need for endocarditis prophylaxis when surgical intervention or abscess drainage is being considered. Blood cultures are only necessary in complicated cellulitis, those requiring surgery, drainage, or in patients who are septic. Start out with broad-spectrum antibiotics. Any purulent drainage necessitates coverage for MRSA. Typical antimicrobial treatment is for 5 to 10 days, longer with osteomyelitis. Now for a couple of case studies. Miranda is a 59-year-old female with a past medical history of diabetes with neuropathy, arthritis, and recent worsening of depression with some episodes of hallucinations, admitted for low-grade fever, fatigue, and painful butterfly rash of the face. The ED physician diagnoses it as facial cellulitis and starts her on Zosyn. Her sed rate is elevated, but her white count is normal. You wonder if her recent psychosis, arthritis, and facial redness are not more indicative of systemic lupus erythematosus. The labs and fever would not contradict this. You know that erysipelas also affects the face in a butterfly distribution. How can you tell the difference? First, a lupus rash is usually flat or raised, but fixed in size and margins. Over the course of the day, you notice that the face becomes less swollen and the erythematous area shrinks. It is bright red. Upon further questioning, she only meets two of the possible 11 criteria for lupus diagnosis. You check an ANA and lupus anticoagulant to see if you can hit the recommended 4 criteria, but they are both normal. You later notice that the erythema extends onto her ear. The ear does not contain deeper dermal and subcutaneous tissues, so you know it is not actually facial cellulitis rather than erysipelas. Erysipelas is most often caused by strep. The Zosyn is probably overkill. While she is a diabetic, the soft tissue infection does not stem from an infected diabetic ulcer. Therefore, gram-negatives and anaerobes do not need to be covered for unless there is another obvious indication. Marcus is a 48-year-old male with past medical history, uncontrolled diabetes with neuropathy, retinopathy, and nephropathy, admitted with right lower extremity cellulitis. There are 2 ulcerated areas on his foot, and he states that these were blisters that popped. He meets criteria for sepsis with fever, leukocytosis, and tachycardia. A plain x-ray shows no subcutaneous gas or obvious deformity. He has severe hyperglycemia of 500, but is not acidotic. His C-reactive protein is 30 and his white blood cells are 28. He is mildly anemic with a hemoglobin of 12. His sodium is 125 and his creatinine is 2. We do not have records to obtain his baseline renal function. You calculate a Lyrinix score of 9, indicating greater than 75% chance of necrotizing fasciitis. You are aware that your hospital does not have the resources to treat necrotizing fasciitis, and the nearest facility that does is a 3-hour drive. You also realize that this is a particularly aggressive disease that can progress to death quite rapidly. Do you transfer? This is a difficult case. The Lyrinix score is worthless without clinical suspicion. In this case, the patient is toxic. He does not have any purplish lesions or dishwater grade drainage, nothing that strongly points to necrotizing infection versus cellulitis with sepsis, although you remember that necrotizing fasciitis is impossible to distinguish from cellulitis in its early stages. His lab values used to calculate the score are concerning, but may actually be baseline values for his creatinine and glucose. When you learn of his heavy alcohol use, you also wonder if the sodium is not low due to baseline liver disease. In this case, you are a provider at a critical access hospital, and you have no available nurses trained in ICU care working today. You're afraid that deterioration would get missed with a nurse who has 4 other patients in addition to this one. You transfer him out. Skin and soft tissue infection cover a broad range of conditions for which the treatment can be quite variable. Characteristic symptoms include warmth, erythema, edema, and pain. These symptoms do not always mean soft tissue infection, however. Combinations of these symptoms could indicate DVT, venous stasis, dermatitis, shingles, and gout, among others. The mainstay of treatment is broad-spectrum antibiotics in most cases, with the severity of infection ranging from a simple abscess requiring outpatient drainage to life-threatening necrotizing fasciitis that can kill within hours. Abscesses are fluctuant or movable. They require drainage, but probably not antibiotics, unless the patient is toxic or there are multiple abscesses. Cellulitis, erysipelas, and abscesses are usually caused by gram-positive staph or strep. You get into gram-negative and anaerobic organisms with infected diabetic ulcers, deep necrotizing or bowel-related infections, and infections of the genital, perineal, and oropharynx areas. Being immunocompromised does not lead to more frequent gram-negative and anaerobic infections, but it may cause atypical infections that won't be covered with your usual broad-spectrum antibiotics. Consider mechanism of injury. Worry about Pasteurella with animal bites and Vibrio with seawater or sewage. Soft tissue infections will not resolve if foreign debris is left within them. They need to be kept clean and dry. Necrotic tissue should be removed. This material is excellent food for bacteria and inhibits granulation and immune functions. Surface cultures pick up the normal flora of your skin. You want to culture deep or not at all. Finally, you can't cure necrotizing infections with antibiotics alone. You have to cut the infection out. This has been an episode of Rural Ed Med. Thanks for listening.